A couple of weeks ago, we talked a bit about the nervous system and how not under volitional control it is, and about how a bit about how to relate to states. And both of the recording devices messed up, and that talk is lost to the ethers. So, you know, in the old days, they all used to go like that. And now I have grasping, like, as if there's some shortage of words that I could say, but clearly I can just talk endlessly because it's been happening for years. So I'm sure nothing much was lost. But I'm going to touch on some of the same things tonight and maybe build on that. And I'm going to talk a bit about desire. So the foundation of this is thinking about, as we've often talked about, the practices of mindfulness and inquiry, of turning the lens of attention on our direct experience. Often, what's at the heart of that direct experience that we are observing and feeling and being intimate with is what we could broadly call our state. So state is a general term referring to what we might call the totality of our experience in a given moment, but often more particularly it refers like to the flavor or the tone of that experience. So there are a few particular channels, I think. I think of them as channels, or spectra is the language I used in my dissertation. You know, aspects of experience that I think are particularly important in determining what our state feels like. Right? One of those is relative energy, like wakefulness to sleepiness is one form of that. The energy that I have that feels actionable, right? Energy to do something, or energy that doesn't feel capable of doing something. So some amount of force, right? Energy to act, right? So the Pali word for that would be virya, energy. Willful energy, it's volitional. It's like the fuel behind volitional actions. So how much energy I'm feeling is really central to the state that I'm experiencing. If I am really low energy, it's often hard to feel good. Right? So low and high energy is not an automatic parallel to pleasant, unpleasant. That's a different spectrum. But at the extremes, right, the extremes tend to be unpleasant unless we're really prepared for them. You know, very, very high energy can be pleasant if the conditions are right for that. Very low energy can be pleasant if the conditions are right for that, like I'm falling asleep, you know, in a beautiful place, whatever. So energy level is one. Focus level is one. So concentrated to distracted. So there's a spectrum of the ability of the attention to be directed, right? Can I keep my attention on something? Another way of talking about this spectrum is, am I engaged? Am I engaged in what's happening, or is it hard to connect with what's happening? So focus is one way of talking about that. And again, focus can be, you know, I can be highly focused, I can be focused in a diffuse way, I can be unfocused, you know, in both skillful and unskillful ways, but I could be distracted in a way. And different from energy, which is kind of, in a certain way, bodily, focus, you know, it feels more mental. It's not entirely mental. It's completely connected with bodily sensation and emotion. But there's this quality of it where it's about the attention being able to be directed. So focus is also about volition. Can I actually place my attention on something and keep it there? Or is it difficult to do that? So that's one aspect of state. And then the third that I really check in on, and this is really part of a regular meditation check-in, like I'm sitting, I want to check in on these three things. How's my energy? How's my focus? And the third one is, what's my emotional state? And I wrote today on the Facebook post a bit about emotion, talking about how emotion as a category, even, we want to hold in some, with some perspective, that emotion is a story that we tell about experience. It's not an absolute, like not all cultures have a word for emotion or experience emotions in the same way. And so the way that we talk about it depends on where we're from and what our cultural heritage is. But broadly, if we say that emotion is the aspect of our experience that starts with the basic affect or charge of pleasant, unpleasant, right? The Pali word is vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, the feeling tone, but then builds on that with coloration to become the various emotional tones that we identify as happy or sad, grieving, longing, delighting, loving, frustration, anger, fear. All of these have both like affective components. They're pleasant or unpleasant in different flavorful ways. Often that affective tone is colored by the story that goes with them. So, falling in love is pleasant, but it's not just pleasant. It has this whole narrative of connection and relationality and meeting and encounter and eros and all of these things, lots of other things woven together. So there's a story aspect and there's a somatic aspect as a pleasurable feeling. There's vibration and energy present. But generally, the spectrum of emotion is the spectrum of vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and then the coloration that comes on those. So our state, taken all together, often I think of as a combination of at least these three things, and often several others, other kinds of aspects of experience can be present. But when we check in with ourselves in meditation or just in mindfulness throughout our life, often what we'll find is we'll get a certain tone. And very often we'll define that tone using the emotional language. We say, how are you doing? Very often the response is something about a mixture between the energetic and the emotional spectra. I'm stressed. Right? So that's kind of an unpleasant emotion combined with a certain kind of energy, Or things are really good lately because such and such is happening. There's a kind of emotional tone along with a narrative. In practice, then, if our practice is to become intimate with suffering, so difficult experience, difficult states, and to understand the conditions that lead to suffering and how to uproot those conditions or how to change those conditions in order to end the experience of suffering, then what we're doing really is we're looking at our states. That's the heart of the internal practice here. State, then, another way we can think about our state is that state is the response of our entire organism to a given set of conditions. So what's happening now? I'm in this place, these kinds of relational connections, this kind of weather, this kind of interactions. And all of those things, plus whatever I've brought with me from the past, combines to be my state, right? So today after work, I went outside and walked on my beautiful country lane. It was a glorious spring evening. It was just beauty, beauty, beauty everywhere. At the beginning of the walk, though, I didn't feel beauty, beauty, beauty because I was carrying some stress from the day. I was still feeling the energetic, there was a little energetic bounce because I was released from work, but there was an energetic dullness having been absorbed in the particular content of my job through the day. And so that's what's happening on the energetic level. And then the story in my mind was more in, was leaning toward the unpleasant, although there are also some lovely things happening in our life here that that was leavening that somewhat. So there was that, there was whatever I was bringing from the past that was a little unpleasant. And then it was meeting the conditions that were really beautiful and pleasant. And for a little while on the walk, there was a kind of mixture of like, I'm kind of down, but the conditions are so lovely. And I was walking with my sweetheart and my kid was on his bike. And pretty soon, the beauty, like the loveliness of the conditions and the fact that I had been released from the thing that was unpleasant and I was now doing something very pleasant, you know, gradually the unpleasantness crossfaded into a very pleasant state. And by the end of the walk, which was only 10 minutes, 15 minutes, everything felt lovely. I was like, oh, this is lovely, you know, conditions. And so conditions shifted. So our state is both responsive to the present and responsive to the past. And in a certain way, trauma, but we could also just say karma, right? The result of past actions, the fruit of past karma is really what we could say. And trauma is the negative side of that, is the dragging into the present of unpleasant situations from the past. And we don't do this on purpose. It's not like I exited the office, which is this very room, and went outside into the lovely outside and thought, you know, now I will ruminate about my job while I go for a walk, right? It was not volitional. What was volitional, and this is where the third spectrum of focus comes in, what was volitional was that I know what to do. Practice has taught me to shift my attention in a couple of particular ways. First, to shift it to the positive, but also then to shift it to the present. And in this case, both were there. The present was quite pleasant. The present was pleasant. And so I shifted my attention to the pleasant present. I'm going to keep trying to say that. And so a couple things happened, right? This is what, when we say like be here now or being in the present, what we mean is turn your attention to the present. You always are in the present, right? But the mind is thinking about other things. It's the volitional turning of attention to what's happening in the immediate sensory conditions that we call being present. And when we do that, this is part of the whole purpose of the training in concentration and tranquility, is we interrupt whatever karma is bubbling from the past. So karma bubbling from the past is another way to say, you know, grasping, right? So some part of me was grasping onto the unpleasantness from the day, right? I might think like, no, I don't want to grasp onto that. I want to let it go. But grasping isn't volitional. You don't grasp on purpose. Nobody grasps on purpose. You grasp because there's an impulse or an instinct to hold on, right? And we've talked about this a lot before where attention to the negative, right? Negativity bias is one of the terms for it, can be thought of as a nervous system impulse to keep ourselves safe because negative information might be a threat or a danger. And so it's our animal body's whole thing, you know, to keep itself out of danger. And so it suggests to our, you know, our old lizard brain, essentially, that we're going to be safer if we keep our attention on the negative, because we're keeping our attention on the possible source of danger. One of the things that is challenging about Dharma practice is that it asks us to train the attention to go against its instincts. The instincts of attention are to stick with the negative and when there's, you know, or to flee from the negative into fantasy and rumination, you know, to endlessly plan or to worry, which is a kind of trying to stay safe. You know, or if the danger is inescapable, like, you know, I'm stuck at work and I don't want to be, for the mind to go off into fantasy or to try to escape from engaging in some way. Thinking of all of these as aspects of our state is a way also of suggesting that they are not our fault and that they're not under our control directly. Right? This is what we were talking about a couple weeks ago, looking at the nervous system and looking at states. Nervous system states are autonomic, and emotions are much more an aspect of the autonomic system than we usually think of. You can't make yourself feel happiness. You can't make yourself feel sadness, right? You can't make yourself feel joy or gratitude or loving kindness. What you can do is you can turn your attention toward things that might give rise to that feeling, right? The feeling happens by itself. The feeling is an autonomic response to conditions. I didn't make myself feel happy when I went out for that walk after work. But what I did was I went out for the walk. So, you know, first put your body and like change what your body's doing. So like, yeah, get yourself out on the walk. But then I could have done the entire walk ruminating about what was unpleasant. And instead I turned my attention, with the help of my darling wife, toward the pleasant, right? Toward the pleasant present. And doing so, you know, doing that didn't make me happy. Like turning my attention to the pleasant, I could still feel the unpleasantness, the suffering that had been there in the heart. But if you're not giving your attention to it, it fades away, mostly. And when it doesn't, it means it has a stronger charge. It means maybe there's stronger karma at play, right? It's more of a crisis emotion. At least that's what your animal body thinks. And in those cases, you know, it takes more work to tune into something pleasant or to tune into the present. When it's mild, you can turn your attention away from it and it will fade away, right? When it's stronger, it takes more work to turn your attention away and you need more support to do that, right? More of a conversation with someone who can help you turn your attention away. And then, right, and it's always important to see the flip side, this is about shifting your state. It's not about actually resolving that suffering. To resolve the suffering, and this is what practice is going to make us do, to resolve the suffering, you're going to have to turn your attention back toward it. And so to actually come to resolution with a difficult emotion requires not turning away from it, right? That's kind of a grounding method, and that's a way to shift your state. But to really process it, of course, you have to turn your attention back to it. And so in mindfulness practice, the instruction then is to, you know, is to really understand, for instance, the hindrances, which is where some of the difficult emotions lie, or to really understand the poisons. So what is desire? I said all that sort of as a prelude to talking about desire. There's desire that is tied to the senses, and it's tied to grasping. There's a kind of like, I want to be more comfortable now. And I want that through food or relational contact or sensuality, or I want a change in conditions. You know, I really wish we had a different house, or I really wish I had a different job, or I really wish I had a different cat. I don't. I love my cat. She could be a little snugglier, but you know, no, she's perfect, almost. And that's desire for you, right? Desire is you know, wanting something to be different. And desire isn't automatically unhealthy. If we're talking about what's, you know, what makes for a good human life, all sorts of desires are, one can engage in all sorts of good and inspiring ways, right? Romantic love can often be wholesome. The kinds of desire that leads one to create art can be wholesome, the desires that lead one to, you know, organize people in communities to do good things, wholesome, right? The desire to change the world toward a more just and equitable place, wholesome desire. All of these are good things, but they're not free, right? And so the shift that the Dharma asks us to do is to, like, the Dharma isn't just a recipe for living a good life. It contains that, right? It says, want good things that don't cause harm, you know, care for people, be compassionate, care for yourself, care for the earth, don't take too much. All of those are suggestions for having a good life with others. And the Dharma contains all of those. But the heart of the Buddha's proposition around really uprooting suffering points in a different direction. And it points in the direction of not just working on our conditions so that they get better, but becoming free from the fluctuation of conditions altogether. And that requires a different kind of desire. And it requires a different kind of desire because, very much because, the core mechanism is turning toward suffering. Right? The thing that you have to do to become free of the states that feel like torment, right? The obsessive mind states, the contracted heart states, the inability to meet the pleasant present because we are full or pressed upon with the sorrows of the past. And for the Buddha, that was the sorrows of the infinite past. If you think about countless lifetimes, you know, of pain and sorrow and loss. The very condition of being unfree is to be so pressed upon by the past that we can't be here for what's here, that we can't actually be fresh in this very moment. And so to resolve this pressing from the past, we have to confront it. We have to become present with it. And the sense that we get is that all of the difficult emotions, the painful parts of desire, the wanting and the grasping that leads to the heart feeling constricted and dissatisfied, that those things are instinctual, right? You're not doing that on purpose. They're woven into this instinct for self-preservation and, you know, the preservation of life and comfort, but they're also woven into this weight from the past, you know, the weight of my childhood pressing upon me and warping my human relationships because I want certain things from people that I didn't get at one point, or I want to feel a certain thing when I'm in connection. And so to resolve this, we have to see it clearly. And that means that once we're in the protective space of practice, which doesn't necessarily mean in sitting meditation, right? It just means that we're doing it intentionally, and probably that we're doing it with some support, like you're in a sangha, you know, and you're learning about the path together with people who care about it and who are ethical and kind and supportive. And then you can say, you know, just as if you were going to an AA meeting and you could say, you know, hi, I'm Sean, you know, and I'm addicted to becoming, you know, I'm addicted to being, I'm addicted to thoughts about the past, right? Hi, I'm Sean, I'm addicted to planning the future, even though it's making me miserable. That with support and a container, what we can do then is we can bring a kind of, it's always provocative to use this word in Buddhist contexts, but I'll call it soul desire. You bring a deep desire for freedom. And that desire for freedom has to be strong, because it has to be strong enough to get us to repeatedly do a thing that we don't want to do. And that thing is to turn toward pain. And again, in a contained, in a well-held way, in a way that's supported relationally and maybe ritually. That's why meditation is a ritual. That's why Sangha is a kind of ritual. Because then we can come together and we can say, oh yeah, I want to know something about this craving, this thing that constricts my heart. What can I know about that? And to know about that, I have to turn toward it and I have to say, oh, I don't want to feel this or that, or I'm afraid of this or that. And, you know, I think a few weeks ago I mentioned this beautiful discourse of the Buddha's where he says, before I was enlightened, I noticed, before I was awakened, I noticed that fear and dread would come upon me. This is from Long Discourses 4, the Bhayabharava Sutta, fear and dread. He said, fear and dread would come upon me. And I thought, how can I work with this fear and dread so that it doesn't overwhelm me? He says, I will go to somewhere where fear and dread is likely to come up. Sacred groves, forests, remote forests, wilderness shrines, places where there might be ghosts or spirits, energy, places where there's strong energy. And I'll go there and I'll practice. And when the fear and dread come upon me, I will not change what I'm doing until the fear and dread dissipates. So if I'm walking, I will keep walking. If I'm sitting, I will keep sitting. If I'm lying down, I will keep lying down. And part of how I read this beautiful telling of practice, I think so much of our practice is like this. Part of how we can read this is that when my state, because I'm pressed upon by past karma and by present conditions, right? He goes into a difficult present conditions to help stimulate it, scary places. When the fear and dread come upon us, the training is stay. Like, don't run away. Don't like, oh, I'm going to shake it off or I'm going to think about something else. Right? Staying in the posture also means staying with it, right? The posture of the mind. So it's like, oh, I'm going to be with that. And he says, and so when I was there in that place and I was walking, the fear and dread came upon me, but I did not change what I was doing. I stayed where I was. And so you have to meet it there. And this is very not intuitive. In the middle of my day, here comes that old fear and dread, and it wants me to do something else, like get it to go away somehow, distract myself, go get a snack, do something else, and instead the teaching is to stay. And so maybe I stop what I'm doing and I say, okay, and I do this all the time in different moments, at work or, wherever. I'm out on the soccer field with my kid and I'm tired, I've kicked a lot of soccer balls now in the last couple of years. And I'm running around kicking the soccer ball and I'll feel the complaint arise like a cloud, coming in. And I'll just say, right, wishing things were different. I wish I was whatever. I wish I was sitting, really honestly, I wish I was just like sitting on my back deck reading a book. That's my craving. You want to know what I crave? That's what I'm craving. I want to sit and read a book. Without so many words, the mind just practices and it says, this is what's here now, and like turn toward it and engage. And the engagement is both with the feeling, like, yeah, don't avoid the feeling. It's true. And engage with what's here. And so, hold the feeling and turn my attention, to the ball, right? Arouse some energy. Or give rise to a boundary and be like, sweetie, I'm done. Papa's got to rest. And that's, and that's good too. Like, but bring choice to the moment. Right? I think so much about this is not being pushed around by the past and pushed around by strong emotion But bringing choice, okay, here's a feeling. How do I be with it? And then what do I do in relation to it? And the instruction is turn toward it, but also change your state. And there's some discernment involved, right? Sometimes it's right to just be like, all right, I'm not going to process, you know, I'm not going to process how difficult it is to parent an eight-year-old right here on the soccer field. So I'm going to set that aside. I'm going to change my state by noticing what a glorious day it is and you know, how strong a kicker my kid is and just exult in his beauty and like just shift attention, right? And that's great, you know. And then at other times, it's like pause, hand on the heart. Oh, I don't like what's happening, you know. And it feels like this. This is what this is like, you know. And you stay there until the fear and dread shifts, right? And so we're always, in a way, in practice, calling upon the soul desire, the deep desire for freedom, for healing, and then freedom, to come in and support us to do the real work of attending to the bodily and emotional desires. To discern when it's right to go with them, when it's right to pull back from them, what's wise action in relation to these forces that course through the body and mind. All right, so we'll pause there. Thanks for your warm, directed attention.